If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share, leave us a message on our hotline number at 513-900-2955.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't.
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two hometown girls who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And today is part two of our interview with Jillian Lauren, former member of the harem of the Prince of Brunei and author of Some Girls, My Life in a Harem, as well as her new book, Behold the Monster. Today, she's going to tell us about what led her to go back to Brunei after she left the first time, smuggling money out of the country, and her meeting with the Sultan.
Ooh. She'll also talk about what it was like falling in love with the man who had complete control over her life. And just to tell you a little bit more about her new book, it details her story of how she got to know the most prolific serial killer in American history.
That's right. She's led a fascinating life. We get into some more stuff today. It'd be weird if we didn't get into some more stuff. It'd be weird if we just said the exact same things as the week before. That's not what we're doing. Megan, kindly tell me culty's thing this week.
Okay, so I was trying to do a deeper dive into my previous cultier thing, but then what just popped up, and I think this is possibly breaking news, the self-proclaimed Crocodile of Wall Street and her husband are arrested for laundering $4.5 billion in Bitcoin.
How do you launder? Okay, what? I don't know anything about this. How do you launder Bitcoin?
It says they did it in a stolen 2016 Bitfinex exchange hack. You guys, this is all just from the headline.
Okay, this goes against everything that tech bros always say, which is that like, oh, Bitcoin is like virtually unhackable. You can't steal it because it's all on the blockchain.
Yeah, it's the cult of having to appear that you have a private jet, that you have a quadrillion dollars.
Yeah, a quadrillion. I mean, who doesn't want a quadrillion dollars?
I mean, I have a quadrillion in Bitcoin.
No, I mean, yeah, that's the society we live in. Maybe that's fucking capitalism. That's what this particular guest can speak to that in particular.
Exactly.
And it's hard to extricate yourself from that because, like, we still live in the society we live in. But we don't need jets, right? Like, we don't need jets. It's one thing to want to, like, live comfortably. Like, that is a very fair and valid thing to want. It's to want a stable home, to want to have enough money to, like, have a good life. But when we're talking, like, private jets and, like, five mansions, that shit is fucking unnecessary and you should be feeding people with that money.
Amen.
Mine is that I learned about a cult that I was shocked to have never heard about.
I'm shocked you've never heard about it, too.
I mean, there are so many. There have been so many. But I was particularly shocked to know that I hadn't heard about this one because it is a Utah like Mormon offshoot cult from the 70s, and I thought I knew about all of those, and it turns out I did not. So I was actually on a podcast this week, a horror film podcast, and one of the hosts brought this up to me. Have you ever heard of Emmanuel David?
I don't know.
So Emmanuel David was an LDS guy who like served his mission like a good Mormon and started having like delusions while he was on his mission, and they sent him home, which doesn't happen very often. He then went to BYU, again, living a pretty normal Mormon life, found this like Swedish wife and had a revelation that he told her that they were supposed to get married, which, by the way, super common. Like, my own family has instances of people doing that, like praying about something and being like, God told me this, therefore we have to do it. All very much embedded in LDS culture. But basically, this guy becomes convinced because of these like delusions that he has that he is a prophet. Shocker. I know.
I'm speechless.
Man in Utah claiming to be a prophet is, well, we've
a
never
man,
heard that one before.
A man claiming to be a prophet? A man claiming to hear the voice of God? Just kidding. Women do it too. Okay, go on.
But it seems like he actually was someone who was maybe a bit, who was delusional, like as opposed to...
I thought you were going to say was actually hearing the voice of God.
He was a prophet. He was literally a prophet. And so I believe in him. no. Yeah. So, like, as opposed to my guy, who I think knows that he's not, he's like just saying whatever he can say to get people.
Yeah, your guy's just
under
like
control,
having fun with it now.
Yeah, but this guy seems like he was genuinely like having hallucinations. He and his wife, they start a family. They start living in this hotel, living this really lavish lifestyle, which I'm unclear on some of the details, but I think they were like kind of swindling people out of their money a little bit. Classic. And like ordering these like fancy French meals. But meanwhile, their children are living with them at the hotel and not going to school. There were five kids, I think, and they were just not going to school. And somehow that got overlooked. And eventually the dad, Emmanuel, one of the people at the hotel, described it as all the boys as like ducklings, because they would just sort of quietly follow their parents, all orderly and polite. So get this shit. So Emmanuel David then kills himself by pumping, what do you call it, into the car that he was in.
Exhaust fumes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kills himself by himself. And then the next morning, the mom and all of the kids jump off the fucking building to join him. And it seems like a couple of the kids jumped and then a few of them were pushed. One of the daughters survived, but it's horrible. Like, it says she was 14. She was brought to the hospital with both legs broken and multiple injuries to the pelvis, arms, jaw, teeth, tongue, shoulders, and spleen, about as bad as you can get and not be dead. 5 blood transfusions, brain damage. Anyway, that girl survived. From what I read, like, still believed in the group years later, even though her entire fucking family died. How sad is that? Isn't that insane?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, just fucking crazy. It's crazy how many people, I mean, he also was talking about the second coming, just like my guy. It's just crazy how many of these guys there are. And I've still never heard of a woman doing this in Mormon culture, although I'm sure it's out there, but probably because historically women can't hold the priesthood, so no one would really believe it if a woman came out and was like, I'm the new prophet, because that would mean God has really become a feminist.
What if there was a new tablet that she also lost?
A new part of like the sealed portion, and it says, yeah, like, right.
But she's like, but I can't find it.
It's bound to happen at some point. But it's just like, the more I learn, I'm like, there's just like endless potential within this culture for people to decide that they're prophet and then have people following them. And I think there were other people who believed in them as well, but they were all sort of family people, family members.
Wow. Family people. Yep.
I introduced my boyfriend to my family people. I don't know if she's still alive, but what a crazy story. And, you know, I don't know, maybe we can find someone who knew them at some point. But that was my cultiest thing. I just thought that was incredibly tragic and fascinating.
Well, it's ruined my day. So thank you.
That's what I'm here for. That's my job.
All right. Well, shall we talk to Joanne?
Let's do it.
To get out of, like I said, like once that dream drains out of you and you forget that there are so many options.
Yeah.
And at least for me, there always were options. I don't have that excuse. When I was in New York and I didn't go back, and they were super duper pissed. You do not want him pissed at you. You know, I was followed in New York sometimes. You can feel it, and it totally makes sense that I was being surveilled. Not all the time, but definitely sometimes, you know, and they still called me on a cell phone, see where I was, and, you know, and life is so hard and complicated and messy, and theater is nothing but rejection, and I had an abortion. Mm. Got a real boyfriend, very nice guy, got pregnant, had an abortion. And, you know, it affects people really differently. For me, there was like a very intense grieving period. And, you know, it was then that I decided to go back. Like, I was walking through a department store and I went over more Ego East, you know, and I went and I smelled his cologne. And I was just like, I just knew the rules of that world.
Right.
It was easy. Yeah, I didn't have to think about groceries. I didn't have to think about my laundry. I didn't, you know, all I had to think about was keeping one man happy, you know, and keeping on my toes. And I called the madam and I asked to go back. And she was just like, they are so mad at you. Like, it's not going to be the same, even if I can talk them into it. And I was like, just try. And they invited me back in. It was like, you know, there was nothing like terrible that happened between us. I mean, I was still sleeping with the prince when I went back. But I just wasn't like one of his special girls.
Right.
So in some ways it was less hard because I wasn't a target of everyone. I think in my book I say, you know, so whoop-de-doo, I had friends. I had preferred having power.
Right.
But I didn't. I stayed, you know, and, you know, I was just still on my grinds. Kept doing it. And then, you know, I went home and I went home for good.
I find it really interesting, this idea. I think you articulated it really well, that like real life is hard and it's full of ambiguity and uncertainty. And if nothing else, a situation like this provides structure. You know what you have to do and you don't have to worry about the horrible, terrifying uncertainty of life. Like, that is a really compelling explanation. And yeah, thanks for articulating that. So how long were you back when you went back?
I think that that was another 6 months. But I knew I was going in for the long haul. I went back with a different attitude. You know, I was just like, go get your money, girl. Also, I had spent so much of that money. Here's another problem with sex workers is that you make this money, then you your worth becomes attached to the money. Your own self-worth to how much you're being paid or what kind of gifts you're getting.
Right.
And the manicures and the maintenance.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The maintenance alone to be like a trophy parent girl.
Right.
You got to keep your shit together, you know? And, you know, and I was like, dumb. I bought like a set of Louis Vuitton luggage because everyone had that there. Like, everyone has a set of Louis Vuitton luggage. You know? I'll have my purse.
Yeah.
But, you know, it like, the girls would go home to LA and buy a Mercedes, like all that. So you start buying yourself things. And also then I think that that's normal. Like to go and get a Chanel dress.
Right. You've just bought 20 of them yesterday. So like, what's one?
Yeah. What am I going to do now? Go to H&M? And also like, what did I know for money? Barely figuring it out now.
Right.
You know, it's not
relatable.
Like I had no idea of the worth. $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, you know, and overall, I think, you know, overall is about $500,000.
Wow.
I know, but I didn't know the worth of that. I did put myself through college with it, but I also put myself through a heroin addiction with it. So,
yeah.
You know.
Nice.
Because I smuggle everything back. I had way over.
I do want to hear about that. Oh my gosh.
And so we would wear like tights. And because we would change our money in Singapore. And then, but the largest denomination we have are $100 bills. So I have $20,000, $4,000, like, you know, I have $100,000 or more. And we would stuff our tights with it.
Wow.
And then wear like big sweatpants.
Oh, shit.
And then we'd wear our fucking jewelry under like a big sweatshirt.
And these are like real jewel, like,
oh my God, like I'm wearing a Cartier necklace, a Tiffany necklace, a Cartier watch, Rolex. Yeah. Fucking serious jewelry. Wow. Oh, I had a Bulgari. I sold that one. I'm so sorry I did. This Bulgari snake, golden snake.
Oh my
that
God.
Came around and it like
wow, clipped amazing.
Right here. And it had these ruby eyes.
I have like a $5 version of that.
It's nuts. Yeah, I had this a couple of years ago. I had this, you know, really sort of like I feel like I needed to do some cleansing around this. And I still had these Chanel bags, which are now like vintage, amazing. And I had a very stylish babysitter. And just one day I lost my shit and just gave her the Chanel bags. I was like, get these out of my home.
Great.
Like, they have terrible mojo, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, why don't you just take them to the real? I got to just let that go. I'm not that into stuff. I mean, I like my nice stuff, but I don't like a lot of it. It's just not like top of my priorities. yeah. ever. So, yeah. you know, I did sell most of the jewelry and gave away those expensive purses. Yeah. The rest of the clothes were destroyed. Although I think they saved, interestingly enough, they saved the traditional Malay costumes.
Oh, like they were angry with you and they destroyed the outfits or?
No, there was a flood.
Oh, wow.
They were able to rescue. I know. Can you imagine? Like there was a flood and like I had like sequins.
This is breaking my heart.
Chanel suit. Ah! That was nuts.
Gone.
Honestly, that's good. Get it out.
Fine. Spark
only stuff that sparks joy, you know?
I write books. That's the gift I get.
Yeah.
You know, is that I get to create meaning out of these experiences. And I think.
Totally.
I mean, even though my books drive me crazy too, because writing is crazy making. But especially with some girls, it was 18 years later I wrote that book. So going back and like, and meeting that girl again, and because she's a character in my book now, I find some compassion for her. Mm-hmm. No, because I have to have compassion for all my characters at the very least. It's the very least I can bring.
Right.
I was like, I'm going to have compassion for myself. I'm going to have compassion for my father. You know, it really did give me a lot of compassion for my father, even though, you know, it didn't work out how I would have liked it to.
Yeah.
You know, eventually it did. I think eventually it made our relationship stronger, you know, and I had more boundaries when I went back. And then it's all sort of out on the table. There isn't this giant secret, which is like a whole fake facade.
Totally.
If you're in Universal City and walking, you know, on like this down the streets of New York, you know, and then you open a door and there's no house behind it. Right.
I'm curious about two things. One, I was watching one of your storytelling clips, which are awesome. And you told a story about, it was actually the rooftop story and how that was one of the turning points for you. Was that the first time you were there or the second time that you were there?
I think it was the first.
Yes. And that was the thing that really sort of pushed me over the edge. That was the turning point. I don't even know if I would say like I was disgusted but like I just couldn't even look at myself. I didn't know that I could translate that into words at the time, but like the whole next day, like I couldn't look at myself, like cover the mirror.
Yeah.
So what happened was I was on a trip with the prince to Malaysia. And when you're not with him, you're locked in your room.
Locked in your room when you're not with him?
Yes. So your room's guarded. So it was me and Fiona and we were next door to each other and we were under guard. Now Fiona had all the guards in her pocket. I don't know how she did it, but you know, once in a while, I feel like we sneaked out to get a manicure once, she would come in my room, and that was technically not allowed. And because we could order anything we wanted, we would order like buckets of caviar and champagne, just like eat it with a spoon, like just because we could. But anyway, sometimes you'd be locked in your room for days, you know, sometimes he'd be with Fiona, not me. So after being locked in my room for a couple days, the guards came to get me. So I went and got ready. I can do a 10-minute black tie.
Nice.
10-minute ready for a black tie event. Nice. I can still do it. And they took me to an elevator, and the prince was staying in the penthouse, but they didn't press the button for the penthouse. They pressed the button for the roof. And I really thought, like, the headlines flashed through my mind. I was like, they're going to throw me off. Like, I know too much. I was at dinner with King Fahd, you know? Yeah. Like, I know too much. I'm just going to be another teenager who, I don't know, got strung out or whatever the hell they would say. Or, you know, just jumped. And again, there would be no accountability. So I said, I feel like it was being, like, when you're in one of those gangster movies and you know you're gonna get whacked, yep. And they're like, get in the car,
mm-hmm. And you just have to do it.
Yeah,
they get in the car, you right. know. So I was just like, okay, like I was like, I'm like Fredo in the boat right now. But I got to the roof and it was a helicopter, and the helicopter hopped over to the next hotel.
Necessary.
Traffic there is bananas, and they're not gonna walk me through the streets. So they took me to the next hotel over, and I went down into this suite that was like, I had no idea what's going on. But I was used to that by then. There was like, the room was like the size of a football field. And I was just looking around, sort of taking everything in, and I hadn't, and there's a Sultan, he's sitting in the room already.
Money guy, the guy on the money.
Yeah, guy from the wall, from the money.
This is the supreme leader designated by God. You know, it's not a democracy. It is not remotely a democracy. You know, he's a dictator.
Yeah, they have health care, but it's still a dictatorship.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, everyone has health care. Everyone has education. It's a small country to have so much money. You know, there's no freedom of the press. And now there's Sharia law that they just put in place. I actually wrote a big piece about it for the Daily Beast that got syndicated, got a lot of play. And I wrote about this exactly this experience. So I got there and he had tea set in front of him and I poured tea and we chatted. We actually chatted. Like he's like, how do you like my country? And, you know, and we chatted and we had drinks. And, you know, after a little while, he asked me to take my clothes off and do a little dance, which, by the way, I really suggest never doing that without music. Awkward.
I love how they don't give a shit. They're just like, just dance. I don't care if it's weird.
I think it's more like more than even watching you dance to no music. It's more about being able to do that. You know, get up and dance. Go stand on your head in the corner.
Right. Totally. Right.
And then he requested oral sex, which I gave him. And then, you know, I was very politely dismissed. He's a very nice man.
Mm-hmm.
Like genial in a way that Prince Jeffrey wasn't. Jeffrey was a little darker. The Sultan just seemed like a little, you know, like he was just having a little fun. Right. Jeffrey was like, you know, you're pretty much just like metaphorically, you know, chained up in his basement.
And was this the only other person you'd had physical encounters with besides Jeffrey?
Yes. There, yes. Absolutely. Mm. So I was sort of a gift. I mean, yeah. I figured out later, you know, that it was meant to be flattering. I mean, it was more for like giving tribute to his brother, but he did think it was flattering. You know, because he was like, you know, like this excited little boy or something. He really wants to impress his brother, even though he's the black sheep. You know, he's the playboy of the family. He's like the bad brother. And but he really wants to impress his brother. And he was just like, Martin is what he called, like really liked you, really enjoyed his time with you. He doesn't like American girls at all. And, you know, and that was when I was really like in love with him in my mind. But I'd never been in love before that. Really, so I didn't have anything to compare it to. No, I didn't fall in love until years later. And you know what? I did it very poorly because I had no trust in me at all. Like that I had this feeling that makes me vulnerable. If I had just been like, if I had been a sociopath myself, if I had been, although, you know, sometimes I think, well, it's where it shows up and how, you know, like I mean I'll turn on my rage and hate like on myself.
We're self-interested, we're designed to make ourselves survive. It makes sense.
It's a very important thing, you know. You identify with your captor because, you know, and you make them right because they're in control of you. It is a really profound survival instinct to go to the winning side.
When you left the second time, was it hard? Did they let you? What was it like?
It was not hard. It was over. I think people really want there to be some crazy inciting incident. I mean, I did pull some shit at the end that like he had me like lie out by the pool and then they would have this big window that they would look at. So, you know, he had like a view when he was working and stuff, you know, and I just took all my clothes off and went swimming. I was not supposed to do that. You know, like I just started to kind of act out and pull some shit, you know. I crashed my golf cart into the garage wall because I was so drunk. coming home from the party, I pressed the gas instead of the brake and I like knocked my nose.
So yeah, you're just getting like way too restless and like, I gotta go. They were like, she's got to go home. And you were like, yep.
Yeah, it's a mutual agreement.
You know, he would still like take me for rides in his car and we would still have sex once in a while. Felt like friends with benefits sex. You know what I mean? Right. Like I wasn't in love with him anymore. I mean, because that's, I think, his driving force. You know, I mean, I'm making a leap there and taking some license, but approval, love. It was genuinely there. That's a, he can feel it if it's genuinely there. And it genuinely wasn't. We were kind of fine. He wasn't fucking with me, which is just like the relationship had kind of come to its close. And I really was ready to go home and try to get to work again. They didn't give me a hard time. I mean, it was my call. I could have stayed forever. I was sort of like, there were a couple of women there like that. Like, if you have like gotten into his good graces enough, they don't kick you out, really.
How much longer did it go on for? Till he was kicked out of the country for extorting $9 billion? Or,
you know, it might have been even 5 years after I got out. But it was interesting because I was at these dinner parties with him where he was talking to, you know, King Hussein and King Fahd and like all these things, like nuts people. And most of the time they were speaking in Malay. And I was sitting there the whole time. But like he would make us go to the polo matches and there would be like four of us, like four white girls. There are no white girls. You can't just go to Brnat. So it'd be like four white girls dressed to the nines, like stuck in a box over here. And then like the wives and the children and he'd be playing polo with Prince Charles.
What ultimately do you think is your biggest takeaway from this experience?
My biggest takeaway is that personal narrative, it gives me a frame. It gives me meaning. It allows me to take these experiences I've had, and you know, Brnat is only one of them, that you can take it and make it a story. Mm-hmm. And that story is yours. You know, my mother's freaking out about the book and this and that, and I was just like, write your own book. It's always there for me. It's there for me in the world all the time. You know, I'm always looking at details. I'm always listening to how people talk. And this started for me in Brnat. My second trip, I started journaling really intensely, and I started journaling like a writer. You know, I started like writing down what people were saying and started to really look at the details. So that was priceless to me. When I never go back and look at my journals unless I'm writing a memoir or, you know, need to look back and say, when did this happen? There were details upon details upon details upon like how it smelled, how it sounded. Like I had, like, it kind of caught fire in me. I was so lonely in spite of the fact that I had friends, but I was truly lonely. And then that carried me. It still does today. Everything that happens, I always just think, you know, go back to your Nora Ephron. It's all copy.
Speaking of stories, your new book and also a series that you did is about your conversations and your relationship that you built with a murderer. Can you tell us about this?
Samuel Little, who died a year ago, is recognized as the most prolific serial killer in American history. He confessed to killing 93 women across the country over 3.5 decades. He evaded justice. He was a sexual strangler. He picked his victims specifically for their marginalized status and counted on the fact that the cops wouldn't care, that probably no one would care.
Right.
That these women went missing. And then beyond that, he was acquitted. There was a failure to indict by a grand jury, and these were for murder. So they had him for murder, and he got off again and again and again. He did 18 months in San Diego for 2 rapes, kidnapping, assault, and attempted murder. There were 2 victims that he left for dead that lived.
Whoa.
He got out and drove to LA and killed 2 people that night.
Holy shit.
Lori Kerridge, she's the last surviving living victim, actually, that we know of. Ooh, she's furious. In the documentary, Lori Kerridge asked to confront the prosecutor from the case who prosecuted Sam so poorly. You know, he was just sitting there basically across the table from her all these years later. That was like 1988, telling her it was her fault.
Mm.
And she went off on him. It was really powerful. Like, but I really thought she was going to crawl over that table and take that man's eyes out, you know, like the injustice and how many women died after and the brutality of her attack and how dismissed she was because she was a prostitute. Like I said, the lack of physical evidence that Sam leaves, he doesn't leave rape kits. So I learned about him. He was in prison. He'd been there for a few years. He was caught through a DNA screening that the LAPD cold case unit was doing with a grant from the Department of Justice, where they screened old evidence, but they would get, you know, when the DNA came back, it would, you know, hit with something in the system or not. And they got three. So the third hit was the one where they were like, we've got a serial killer. And Beth Silverman, the prosecutor, said, all right, like, if you can get him, I'll indict. It took them a long time to get strong enough evidence, hard to try a cold case. They like chased him across the country. He's a transient. They were 2 days behind him all the time. They finally caught up with him in Kentucky. And the marshals extradited him to Texas first and then to L.A. She always thought that there were many more murders across the country. And she tried to mobilize interest in departments, you know, saying, hey, maybe you want to look at your cold cases. You know, I believe this man killed a lot more people and here's his M.O. And she just wasn't able to get a fire going. And I thought, you know, as the media, as somebody with a voice, a public voice, that I could put heat on it. Like Michelle McNamara, you know, did not catch the Golden State Killer, but she put heat on that for so long that law enforcement could no longer ignore it.
Right.
You know? And so I was like, that was kind of my goal. I was just like, I'm going to put heat on this. And so I started corresponding with him as I waited for my visitor's pass. And I really thought, you know, due to my unusual skill set, I was just like, if anyone can get this man talking, it's going to be me. And I'm going to do it. Like, it was just this wild endeavor. And I was talking to New York Magazine and they said, okay, like, maybe, like, we don't want to do another gruesome serial killer thing, you know, and just exploit it. If you can come up with an angle, we'll do it. And I was like, all right, you want an angle? I'll give you an angle. And I went in there and I talked to him. You know, I could never have predicted what the next 3 years of my life were going to look like after that. But he lied the first day. I was there with him for 3 hours. And so this is men's maximum security prison. It's really a not a pleasant experience. Very interesting. It was great to be able to write about it, you know, and write about things like, you know, the kindness I saw that women treated each other with real kindness. You know, in the waiting rooms and stuff for hours with people you would never be in a room with. There was a lot of kindness. Someone needs a tampon or someone's baby's crying or, you know, no one wants to be there. I felt like a phony, of course, because I did want to be there. These people are visiting their loved ones. I'm here to see a monster because I want to. I have always been interested. I mean, there's a lot of criticism about, you know, prurience and exploitation in true crime. To me, crime is just a story with really high stakes. And it fascinates me. And serial killers are fascinating. We don't understand them, you know? And it makes us wonder about human nature. It makes us wonder, like, what is this stuff we're made of? He's not a different species, you know? I wanted to see it. I wanted to do it. I thought I'd write one article and it would be done. And then I found myself in the middle of, so the second day he starts confessing to me. It was like the cliche, like ice water poured over my head when he started in. And I was like frozen in place. It was sort of like, oh my God, I just got what I asked for. Woo. I mean, that's a whole other story, the mind control and the, you know, and having this really deeply intertwined relationship, long-term relationship with a psychopath. And I also found myself in the middle of an FBI investigation because as he started talking to me, he was talking to a Texas Ranger, James Holland, also had this big plan to get him to confess. He's sort of an expert serial killer whisperer. He's sort of one of the more recognized detectives in the country in that field. He's an intense interviewer. In this case, you know, it wasn't as bad because Sam was so willing. And Jimmy was his best friend. Jimmy and me and the devil made three. And I had to keep my mouth shut. Yeah. So I'm sitting on this story, which is, I was like, okay, well, you know, it's a long form piece. I think it was like the length of Catcher in the Rye when I turned it in. I think it really was like 80,000 words. Wow. I sat on that damn story and kept my mouth shut. And like, they gave me no warning at all that it was going to break. I told the FBI, I told the federal government to go fuck themselves. I really did. And I had to hear about it all the damn time. You know, it's just like, can you sworn officers of the law with like multiple graduate degrees from Ivy League universities and stuff?
Grow the fuck up.
Yeah.
But you know what? I was just so pissed. I mean, much like the story of some girls, like it really took me to the edge of my everything. And, you know, the edge of my sanity, the edge of my capability to handle it. And sort of that's the story that makes a good book. Like totally. The one where you're not sure she's going to make it to the end. I mean,
yeah.
Make it because she wrote it, but you suspend that disbelief. It was wild, and I went down to Texas, you know, and I was like talking to him in Texas and soothing him, and you know, I just kept him really, really happy.
It's like the silence of the lambs.
Yeah, you're Clarice Starling. You
know, and by design too, because you know that is my favorite movie, and just accidentally resembled the Clarice walk to the cell. Like that was sort of what was in my mind. I was, right. And I had a little panic attack online. It's like you wait for 2 hours in your car or 3 hours in your car before they even let you in. If you want to get in, you got to get there at like 6 a.m, get in line. So, and then they open the gate at 9:30. The things that resemble that are absolutely genuine. Like I got what I wanted. It really felt like that sometimes. You know, I was his confidant. I was his everything. I kept him stable and I kept him talking. I think of, you know, my years of sex work and addiction and just being an idiot, you know, things I did, guys I went home with, stole my shit in New York, you know, that I lived through all that. I talked my way out of it mostly. I would talk my way out of stuff. So I was like, that's what I'm going to do.
I can't wait to read it. It's called Behold the Monster Confronting a Killer.
You know, I try with my best intentions and all of my heart to give voice to these women whose voices were taken away from them. And maybe I don't do it perfectly all the time. And I always ask their permission. You know, but, you know, I wanted to represent the victims. And I also wanted to represent some of the science around it. And my relationship with Sam is sort of the backbone of it. And talk about all the amazing police work that was done by people on the case. So,
well, I can't wait. What a fascinating life you have led. You're like the female version of that Most Interesting Man in the World character in the commercials.
Dos Equis, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, I don't often drink beer, but when I do, it's Dos Equis. And they're like the most interesting man in the world. Yeah, but that's you.
Well, I think that reference might be like 12 years old. I'm right here with
you.
But I will just say I worked on one of those commercials once as like an extra and he left in like a really shitty car. And I was like, that sucks.
No, because when you do commercials like that, you're making bank. So that means he's humble. He's humble.
Yeah.
Or he's like got a lot of alimony payments.
Something. You would if you were the most interesting man, wouldn't you?
True. Thank you so much, Jillian. It was so great to talk to you and great to meet you.
Yeah, it's great to meet you guys. I'd love to, you know, just stay friends.
Yeah, let's do it.
I mean, how often do you meet people who share your niche interest? Usually I do podcasts that are a little more, you know, general but I was just like, yeah, this one's my thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Jillian.
Awesome.
All right. Keep in touch.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay. So we already know what your answer is because you talked about it last week.
Yeah.
But one thing that we had discussing was this idea of Stockholm syndrome, or sort of like falling in love with your captor. Did you have thoughts on that, Megan?
I did. I was so stunned to kind of reread in her book after we've been talking about this for so long. Just, she was talking about being taken from the compound where she was staying, brought to a hotel. She didn't know where she was. She didn't know if she was safe. She gets put in a room. She talks about it on the podcast. It's freezing. She can't pee. There's nowhere to go. And she's left there for hours and hours and hours. And she said by the time he finally came for her, which was purposefully done on his part, she is so grateful to the person who opens that door that she felt her whole energy shift towards him. And I'd never really seen it put that simply before and really processed how fast it can happen, because that's a half a day or a day. I can't remember the exact length of time, but, you know, imagine growing up with these kind of things, or like getting introduced to it when you're younger, or being around it for years and years. You know, it's just crazy how deep this stuff can go.
Right. I think that's super interesting. It always makes me think of the thing I've referenced a million times, which is Homeland.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also he was dreamy.
Well, it's unrelated, but yes.
I'm just saying, it makes a little more sense to fall in love with him.
No. I don't mean him. I mean in season one, when he is captured.
I thought you meant the Russian hot guy. Excuse me.
No.
I got you. Yes, Brody.
Yeah. I just, whatever. I'm not going to talk about it again because people are probably sick of hearing
you
that story.
You love Brody.
I literally haven't seen the show in like multiple years, but it made it really clear for me that idea of like, if you... Okay, so most people join a cult when... I mean, they're not necessarily suffering, but like something in them is like needing an answer, right? Like, so there's some kind of suffering that's happening, or like mild suffering, and this person or group comes along and they're like, I can fix this. I can relieve this, right? It's a relief of pain is what it feels like when it first happens. And that is a really interesting way to like manufacture that experience in a condensed way. Yes, you can do that slowly over time because somebody isn't under your control. But if they're already under your control, how do you speed that process along? You cause them suffering and then relieve it. I find that concept to be super interesting. Like, our brains can only handle so much at once, right? So like anything that offers relief, if we're suffering physically and emotionally at the same time, is going to flood our bodies with like positive emotions, and that's going to then create a bond to that person. Yeah, I totally makes sense to me. Makes me think of Patty Hearst. Have we talked about Patty Hearst?
We haven't, but we should. We should do an episode on her.
I'm desperate to interview her. If anybody knows anyone who knows Patty Hearst, I'm like, I want to interview her so badly. I read that book that What's-His-Face wrote on her, and I think he did not do her justice at all. He really took the position that she was acting at Stockholm syndrome as a defense, but I'm like, look at what she actually experienced. Of course you're going to become radicalized in that situation. How would you not? I mean, if people don't know the Patty Hearst story, definitely Google it. She was kidnapped and then joined the little domestic terrorist cell that had kidnapped her, but she was also like kept in a closet and raped a bunch. So I don't know. Fascinating.
Man, Stockholm syndrome, not a joke.
I always wonder what sociopaths, or like, let's say malignant psychopaths, not necessarily just a general sociopath, but is listening to our show and like taking notes and being like, aha, cause suffering, then relieve it. That is what I should do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No one do that, please.
Yeah,
don't do
you're
that.
You're not being smart. We're caught you already. Just stop it.
We're caught you already.
Oh God, I'm so tired.
I'm sorry. I'm giving you shit.
Okay. You guys, we're so glad you listened to this episode. We can't wait to see you here again next week. Remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never, ever trust me.
Bye.